This is the real weepy and like tragic part of the story beginning, oh my brothers and only friends.
I'm in for four potential getaway drivers. Go.
No!
But I was told that I could listen to the radio at a reasonable volume.
No!
Excuse me, we have a little bit of a hurry.
Hang on, Voltaire.
It's yet another long series of perversions in an attempt to avoid responsibility.
Welcome once again to the Means Podcast, a program we like to call This Just In. For a half hour every Monday, we bring you a random sampling of things we find interesting or funny. No structure, just a conversation which we encourage you to participate in by emailing us your responses. This is Tanner Higgin, podcasting from Los Angeles.
And this is Chris View, podcasting from Detroit.
Now, I believe we might have a shorter program than normal today, but that shouldn't hurt anything. I think we've got some good topics to talk about. The first one we wanted to discuss was a recent news story probably a lot of you are familiar with, having to do with Sony and their anti-piracy CDs.
This is something that was revealed to me on the podcast for This Week in Tech. And last week sometime I was listening to it, and they were talking about how Sony was embedding some software on their CDs so that if ever you put it on your computer, it would find if you had illegal downloads on your computer, and then it would basically, I don't know if it removed them or just made them inoperable. And so people who are hackers, they were exploiting this, because what they could do is they could tap into that anti-piracy type thing, and they were able to embed Trojan horses and whatnot on that, and so people's Norton antivirus or whatever antivirus software wouldn't capture the Trojan horses before, it just wouldn't recognize them. And so people have been really coming down hard. And I was surprised yesterday. I just did a quick search of some news stories, and on the BBC they had a story that they're running as of Saturday, saying that Sony is going to suspend the production of their music CDs that have the anti-piracy technology because of the vulnerability it presents to people's computers. So it's kind of like one small step in defeating this, because I'm obviously against what Sony's doing. They should never be able to tap into someone's computer, you know, without my knowledge, without me knowing. They should have a label on each CD. That way I know that they're going to try and do that. It's shady if they do that.
Yeah, and this sort of relates to that story, too, you probably heard about the printers, where certain, I guess, Canon printers and other printers, and I have a Canon printer, had technology embedded in them that aided the FBI or other such government agencies in tracking where documents were originating from.
Wow.
Which it's just shocking to me that this is actually happening, and that there's people running these companies and in the government that think this is acceptable. That they can embed these spying technologies and, you know, technologies that infringe on our basic rights.
Exactly. That's what it comes down to, is like, at what point do my rights become squandered underneath the rights of a corporation? I understand the arguments against piracy. I do. I totally get them. Doesn't mean I'm going to follow those, but I'm just saying I get them. But at the same time, it never gives them a right to spy on what's on my computer, because what's on my computer is private domain, unless I choose to be part of a group that shares that. And I don't choose, when I purchase one of their CDs, I do not choose to be part of a group of file sharers. I'm merely taking a file and putting it onto my personal computer. And then somehow, though, I don't know if that's legal yet. I don't know what ramifications this is having in the legal world, if anyone's really pursuing this tightly. But, you know, for me, that's one of the most obvious, blatant intrusions. You know, that's like you giving me a CD or sending me a file online or something, and then putting something in there that can help you spy on my computer so you can read my conversations with people over Instant Messenger or something. It's illegal, I think, and it's just wrong.
It's bad enough that people have to live with the fact that through UPC codes and, you know, purchasing computer systems, that there are people out there that know they bought the Goo Goo Dolls CD. But now it's even worse that not only do they know they bought the Goo Goo Dolls CD, but that they have kiddie porn on their computers. That makes it even worse.
Yeah. Well, let's be honest. Anyone who bought the Goo Goo Dolls CD does kind of need to be put in prison. So if they want to put it on select labels, for instance, if you buy the new 50 Cent album, hey, you know what? That's kind of a crime anyway. So why not put it on those? But on the good CDs, on the albums that I care about, that's the ones that they should just stay out of the business. The ones I'm going to purchase anyway, and I don't want them on my computer. But, you know, if somebody buys a Goo Goo Dolls CD, I'm all for imprisonment when it comes to that.
I can't, you know, really thinking about it, man, I just don't buy CDs anymore, period. So this really doesn't even affect me, but...
It doesn't affect me either, but I'd like to be an advocate for the rights of people who...
Yeah.
I know my roommate purchases CDs, like, 3 a week, maybe. And while he doesn't really... He's not into piracy or anything, so it's not a big deal for him. But let's just assume he had something on his computer that was a Sony product. Let's say he liked to play, you know, emulated games. He might buy, you know, the next hit album from some band, and then it turns out that they're gonna deprive him from playing his games. Sure, he might have downloaded them illegally, but they're on his computer now, and it's not their business to find out that they're on his computer.
And what's strange to me about the whole piracy thing is I don't believe that Apple is really complaining about piracy nowadays because they are making buckets of money with iTunes. I mean, they're starting to compete with Dell in terms of revenue. I was recently reading it.
Mm-hmm.
The whole piracy debate, I think, hopefully it's starting to fade away.
Yeah. I think it might be slightly. You know, Apple did the right move by just when they did iTunes, and you know that's probably the best thing that they could have ever done because they've basically collaborated with the music industry to release songs for 99 cents, and you know that's a negligible amount when, in all honesty, of course people are going to still pirate when it comes to you know songs that they don't want to pay for. But then again, you know, then I think about it, and you can see how crappy the music industry is when I remember Apple was giving them a significant amount of that 99 cents, and the music industry still wanted to bump up the price and their percentage. So, you know, it's obvious which side of this is kind of the evil empire here, and it's definitely the music industry.
Yeah, I'm almost kind of surprised by my by how much I've enjoyed using iTunes, just because I just like the convenience of it. I don't want to risk getting viruses on my computer by using these peer-to-peer networks or, you know, torrents. And it's just the convenience and the safety, and then deliver the product for a good price, and I'm all for it. And that fixes the whole piracy problem. Because I used to when Napster was in its heyday, I used to download tons of stuff for free.
Oh, God. But I used to... What we used to call, this is a bad term, but we used to call raping people's inventories.
Yeah.
We would just go through and find a guy who had a great connection with us and just rape the crap out of that song list.
But I don't even want to congratulate Apple too much because I'm still sort of pissed how they created their own little file for the iPod and then it can't be transferred over without it getting some third-party shady software to rip in.
Yeah, that's garbage too,
yeah.
But... You did something doing this podcast about paperback books, and what exactly was it that you're bringing up? Because I'm not quite sure I was grasping that.
Well, Leo Laporte on a This Week in Tech quite a while ago just made an offhand comment about how he thought that paperback books were sort of the pinnacle of achievement in just delivering writing. Like they had finally gotten a system that was pretty much perfect. You couldn't go many other options with the paperback book and improve upon it because it was small, easily transportable, cheap. They last a pretty long while, and they're easy on the eyes. And then I was comparing this to the fact that I've been reading some hypertext fiction lately, and the fact that never caught on because the first ones appeared in the early 90s, and no one really cares. You don't see them being popular. And I was just thinking, like, is the paperback book about as good as it gets?
I'm in the school of thought that says, yeah, I actually think it is as good as it gets. Now, to play devil's advocate when it comes to hypertext versions of books, I've only had to use that one time. And I will say it was extraordinarily convenient because the way that the site was set up that I went on to, that where I was using this, they allowed you to search keywords within chapters, and you could really, as research goes, you know, this was a historical paper, and I kind of need to expedite as much, you know, time as possible here when I'm writing a paper. So when I would search, let's say, immigrants, it would pop up every time, you know, every keyword. So it was basically like Googling just the book, and that was nice. But at the same time, I can't do that anywhere, anytime. I couldn't be sitting in the doctor's office and pull out, you know, the hypertext version of a book and search it. But with a paperback book, I can put it in my pocket, or I can put it in, you know, sack I might be carrying. And just the sheer convenience of paperback. And it's the same thing that you and I discussed when we were deciding that the means was going to be an actual tangible copy. Because when you have something in your hands, it's more of an experience of, it's not just a visual experience, but it's also the touching experience where, you know, your fingers deliver messages to your brain too, you know, and when you can feel the text, when you can feel the way that the gloss on the cover, that adds a whole new element. And maybe that's not adding to what the words are saying, but it adds to the experience itself. And maybe that in itself stimulates the brain to work harder. I don't know. I'm not an expert in this, and I haven't done any scientific research, but that's where I would stand on the issue.
Paperbacks are a hell of a lot more pleasurable to read than something on a computer screen. It's just, no one, you can't sit there for any extended amount of time and read on a computer screen. It's impossible.
Yeah.
But I think also on this book I'm reading called Cybertext by this guy Espen Arseth, he brings up an interesting point that the structure of hypertext and computer delivered text lends itself to things such as encyclopedias and dictionaries and little small packets of information that are searchable and linkable. But when you get to just regular novels and such, it becomes an issue of aesthetics because that structure no longer aids it in its delivery. Mm-hmm. So, it becomes a question of when you put it on the computer screen and link it with hypertext, is it giving it any extra aesthetic value? And it sort of seems like no, it isn't, because if they were more aesthetically pleasing via hyperlinking, then you'd see more of it, but you don't, because he makes the point that a lot of people think hypertext fiction is less linear because you get to click links and make choices, but he says it's actually a lot more linear than less linear, because there's only a set number of choices, and a lot of times you click a link, you're stuck with only a certain amount of choices, whereas a book, you can flip and turn and jump back and forth as much as you want. Nothing's ever limited. So I'm really starting to think maybe this hypertext thing is sort of dead. That I can't go any farther.
Yeah, I've never really, you know, I remember back in the mid to late 90s, they kept telling us, you know, the future is going to be all libraries are going to be online. You know, all text is going to be online. We'll never need to even work with paper. I know within the government, they always talk about the paperless government, things like that. As much as I'm an advocate for saving trees, you know, I really enjoy the paperback book. I enjoy going to a library and sifting through the annals and the catalogs and everything, you know. And it just seems to me like, I think one of the crowning achievements of our species is that we've been able to catalog things in, I keep using the word, but in tangible form. And there's something just less, it's just not as, I don't know, it's not as cool to me about searching something online. It's certainly cleaner, it's not my preference, I guess. And I'm sure there's people who prefer the hypertext, but to me, nothing will beat the experience of going into a library and opening up a dusty old book. You know, it's just not the same experience, and it might contribute to the lack of, it might not inspire me as much. I might not have as many creative ideas on how to approach a book. Half of what I'm learning about in a historical text is, you know, it could be embodied in the fact that the text I'm reading is in itself historical, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so. And I just like the idea of being able to write in my books, too, you know, take notes in them, mark off pages, and I guess it just, we need another step, you know, maybe these sort of malleable digital editable pages or something along those lines, but that's the only way I could see it replacing the paper. Okay, the next topic was that you had just seen today Good Night and Good Luck by George Clooney's directorial debut.
And this just in, I think he could be one of the number one contenders for best director this year. Let me just say, because I just saw it today, I haven't had time to fully digest it. I mean, I literally saw it maybe 4 hours ago, so I've still been kind of having an internal dialogue with myself. But let me try and summarize it as best I can. In this movie, in Good Night and Good Luck, we're faced basically with a mirror image of what's happening in today's political climate, which is kind of why this movie, I think, is so imperative. We experience the tenseness and the fear of McCarthy's 1950s, where anyone could be labeled a communist without a shred of evidence to support the claim. And you can see parallels to what's happening in our culture now with, you know, Patriot Act type stuff and enemy combatants. And let me go back to the movie. In terms of the movie, the performances were spot on. The guy who plays Edward R. Murrow is David Strathairn, I think his name is. And it's probably the best acting I've seen all year, hands down. And the film itself, it comes at kind of a slower pace. It's segued by these brief shots of this this elegantly dressed, breathy, not a lounge singer, more like a jazz singer. And that matches the mood of the film, too. And it's kind of like the nuance that they use in the film to bring, to just kind of lull you through it. But at the same time, you still feel this paced intensity, this battle between Murrow and McCarthy. And it's kind of like, because like unlike other films, this was actually a reality. And whichever side of this political umbrella on, it's an era that serves as testament to how awry things can go when questioning those in power or squelching the voices of the minority, how that can have dire consequences for society. And so, this, like for me, the single most powerful aspect of the film is that they utilize actual footage from the McCarthy hearings and his rebuttals, his nationally televised rebuttals to what CBS was claiming, and more specifically what Murrow was claiming. And, you know, you can just see what a douche McCarthy was. Because, like the current administration, he rarely finds facts to argue. Instead, he kind of relies on rally cries and these emboldened claims and speech that and this rhetoric that only serves the purpose... It only serves, like, on a base level, because what I'm trying to say is it rarely goes beyond pointing out that, you know, you're either with us or you're against us. That's his mantra, and it focuses solely on him inspiring this nationalism. And notice how I don't use the word patriotism, because those two are not synonymous. McCarthy, just like this administration, tries to identify the other, and then tries to make it evil. So in his case, he was trying to identify communists, who were basically non-existent. And you also see how he ruins people's lives by doing this, because there's another political commentator who comes on the television after Murrow, and you can just see his gradual downfall after they label him a pinko commie. And he's not, obviously. He was never really proven to be one, as far as I can tell. But he, it's not spoiling anything in the film, but he does end up committing suicide. And this is because of these bold claims that were never substantiated. So anyway, with all these parallels between them and, you know, the 1950s and now, and just in terms of it being a really good film, I highly recommend Good Night and Good Luck. And I'd like to think that this just might be the wake-up call many people in the country still need, if they haven't already heard the news that last year's presidential decision is way out of style based on Bush's ratings right now. So,
I think it's just exciting that we've got a politically relevant movie out, because it seems like Hollywood has been very not relevant for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. So it's exciting to see something that is very relevant and very timely. Mm-hmm. And that, unlike Fahrenheit 9/11, won't be sort of a polarizing film, but might actually connect to people on a deeper level, sort of just showing how history can repeat itself.
Right. Well, you know, the sad thing is, though, when I went to do some research on this after I got home, I wanted to see what the ratings were preliminarily on IMDb, and of course, you can see the message boards, and immediately I noticed people are talking in terms of conservatives and liberals, and some people are saying McCarthy was right, and it's like, you know what, like, people aren't learning, and that's the problem, you know, and I can already see people looking at Good Night and Good Luck and saying, oh, this is told from a very liberal perspective, and my immediate reaction is no, it's told from a very factual perspective, because whether or not you believed in Murrow or McCarthy was on a witch hunt that was unsubstantiated, and Murrow, whether you agree with how he called him out, Murrow was still basically saying, no matter what, the press should never be afraid of telling the other side's story. Because for every person who's identified as, you know, a good American, there was the other person who was being called out and was being told that they were a communist, even if they weren't. And that person's story deserves to be told just as much as the person who's, quote-unquote, a good American. So, and those parallels exist today, because today they want to squelch people saying, you know, they want to say you're a bad American if you don't support a war effort. But, you know, why is that person a bad American? You're not really evaluating what that person is saying. Hey, you know, do you understand what I'm getting at? It sucks, because this is a good lesson. Like, this movie can serve as a good lesson, but I think people are still going to extract from it what they want to. And so I think they're still going to see good enough. This is just another liberal attempt at, you know, or attempt by the liberals to demonize. It's annoying me just thinking about it, but this movie, I can't recommend it highly enough. Honestly, it's probably the best film I've seen all year, as of right now, next to Batman Begins.
Yeah, it's too bad that simple protection of basic and almost, you know, set-in-stone rights becomes mm-hmm. a liberal conservative issue. I find it hard to believe somebody on a message board was defending McCarthy, but
yeah, according to them, they have they apparently have these. When the Soviet Union collapsed, there was documents that were released. According to this person, I'm not gonna say that this person's correct, but documents were released and it identified the names of agents who were actually within the government in the United States and that who McCarthy, 58 or whatever years it was, who he identified were actually on the Russian papers as well. So, but that's bullshit. It's a bullshit claim. It's not substantiated. And whoever this person is on the message board, they're one of the millions of misinformed people who, for whatever reason, feel like they need to be vocal about how dumb they are. So,
armchair historians, the best people in the world.
Yeah, somehow they've become my colleagues, and I'd just like to fight each one of them.
All right, now I wanted to discuss another revelation after moving to the West Coast, because in this class I'm taking, we discussed time and literature, and somebody had pointed out that in the L.A. area, everything sort of, even, I guess, L.A. is made up of different little zones and different little sectors, and it's very unlike most cities. Like, the only other city I can really compare it to would be New York, and that there's very distinct little pockets. But they were saying that also, in this book, this one woman was reporting on by Steve Erickson called Amnesiascope. I guess he plots out the different time zones of the L.A. area and how everyone operates on a different time zone depending on where they live. And I was thinking about it in a broader sense that since I moved out here, I experienced time differently than I did in Detroit. In that, in Detroit, I went to school about an hour and a half from where I lived, my hometown, and that distance seemed so long that I would only travel it on holidays or special occasions. But here, I'll just get up and drive an hour and a half to go do something. And that my whole perspective of experiencing time and what reasonable amounts of time to do things has completely shifted. And I've been trying to get a handle on it to understand it, because here, if I drive an hour and a half, I'll go maybe half the distance I did in Detroit. I'm trying to think, is it the actual distance that makes the time real to me? Is it that I'm only going a short distance, so the extra amount of time I've got to experience here doesn't seem as much because of the distance traveled isn't as much?
Mm-hmm.
It's a whole, I don't know if you've ever experienced anything like that, where your whole perspective of time is transferred and altered.
You know, I can honestly say I haven't, and I think it's because whenever I gauge, like, for me, distance and time are you know, when I go to gauge how far I'm driving, it's always in reference to how much time it'll take me to get there, and I get really upset when, if I'm on the road for an hour and a half, if I only travel 30 miles or whatever, you know, I'm a little pissed, because I'm used to, like you said, in this area at least, you can get from, you know, from Detroit to the border within that amount of time to Ohio, or you can get, you know, a good way into Canada. I guess I know where you're coming from, because the perception of time for me always is synonymous with how much distance I can travel. I know that my miles per hour on my speedometer can almost equal out how far I'm going to go. And if I don't know if I'm explaining it that well, but if, like, I feel sorry for you almost that you have to that with time you're saying, all right, I can budget an hour and a half of my time, but only travel 20 miles from where I'm from my home to get there. It's almost like a waste of time. It's not a good thing, I don't think. Do you see that as a good thing? Do you feel like you're shedding some sort of negative skin that you've had on all your life? Is this a good thing for you?
No, I think it's horrible, but I'm sure that if I stayed here longer, I would adjust like everyone else is,
mm-hmm.
and just find it normal, because people here, they have these immense commute, you know, hour and a half, 2 hour commutes every day, and it's just normal to them because their experience of time and distance traveled is completely different than my reference point. Mm-hmm. You know, for my reference, if I'm going to get the best value of an hour and a half, I've got to travel the same distance that it was from Detroit to East Lansing, not from, right. you know, Riverside, California to, you know...
like Ontario.
It is so crazy, but it really illustrates perfectly how everyone experiences time differently, and their perception is very, mm-hmm. very almost regionalized. Because I'm sure people here, the way they live their lives is substantially different from the way Detroiters live their lives, just because their whole sense of time is different.
Mm-hmm.
And time dictates our entire lives. You know, we time out everything. Everything is scheduled, and it's fascinating to think about. And
it's something I never really thought about until you brought it up today. But
and then this sort of segued into another idea that I was thinking about, and that's the fact that here daylight savings is a lot different. That if you look at, there's a lot of maps on the internet of daylight savings, and how much savings each region of the world gets, because as you get closer to the equator, it evens out, mm-hmm. and as you get closer to the poles, you get more and more summer light. And out here, it's almost, because we're getting closer to the equator, it's a lot different, and that the extension of the summer daylight we get here is not very substantial compared to how it normally would be without daylight savings. So coming out here, I'm just starting to hate it because it gets dark. It gets pitch black here at 5 p.m.
Wow.
And when that, and with that happening, it makes me lazy, you know, and just like lethargic, and it turns into 5 p.m. I'm not going to go out. It's already dark out, and it just, daylight savings has killed me.
You know, but that, don't you remember how it was when you were living in Detroit? Because I know, like, you don't like daylight savings time, but I love it, because when I was a kid, what that meant was, because your parents weren't allowed to, they weren't allowed to call you in that extra hour early, that meant you had an extra hour to play out in the darkness, because that would be gypping you as a kid. So I still have this nostalgic reason for liking daylight savings time. And even today, when we were driving home from the movie, I noticed, you know, it was already getting dark, and yeah, for right now, for the time being, I get really tired, and it feels like my timing is all off. I feel like, you know, it was 4:30, 5 o'clock, and the sun was starting to set, and I'm thinking, my God, it feels like it's 7 o'clock right now. And, I realized then I still had another 6 hours or so to go. But I like it when it gets dark out early. That means it gets bright out a little bit earlier in the morning. And by getting dark out a little earlier, that means I can start my nightlife out at 6 o'clock at night. So for me, it's kind of a good trade-off. I like it. I like when it's dark, and especially in the wintertime here in Michigan, because when it starts snowing, it's beautiful when it's, you know, pitch black out, but the white snow lights everything up. So a lot of these things are nostalgic reasons. But I'm a fan of it. It sucks because I think they're getting rid of it. I'm pretty sure Congress passed legislation to get rid of daylight savings time that happened earlier this year. And so I think we're basically going to try and... there's some... I don't remember exactly how it works, but I know they did, like... it was called, like, the Energy Policy Act or something. I don't know. It's going to mess everything up for me. So that means, basically, when I go trick-or-treating on Halloween, it's not going to be dark outside anymore. That's what it means.
I guess when you are in Michigan, it is great during the summer when it's light out for a long time, but out here, it doesn't matter. It just, if you look at the map, the map I'm looking at specifically is webexhibits.org/daylightsaving/c, as in the letter C for cat, .html. And if it allows you to go from region to region and see exactly how daylight savings affects you and how much sunlight you get depending on what month you're in. And here, it doesn't do anything but screw me up. Because I'm not getting anything more in the summer, hardly, and I'm getting a ton of darkness.
Yeah.
And that 1 hour of extra darkness is just killer. Ugh.
Well, how would you handle it if you lived at one of the poles, man? You'd be screwed. Because you'd have perpetual dark during half the year and then perpetual light the rest of the year.
Yeah, that is messed up.
Yeah, those people are crazy. If any of you guys are listening to our podcast, please email me and tell me how you survive. Because there's no way in hell I could do it.
No, that God, that would be so weird. I guess that's all we have for this week. Yeah. I'm probably
we're experiencing
came in short.
Daylight savings time lag right now on the internet.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's all I have to say. If anyone has any comments on Good Night and Good Luck, please email them to me. That's chris@the-beans.com. Because I'd really like to know other people's perspectives on the film. I loved it, so.
Yeah, and we'd like to remind everyone that issue one of our literary journal, The Means, is out. It's great. You can pick it up at the-means.com/journal. There's a button on the right-hand side that says buy the issue for $8, or the subscribe button. Click on either of those. I'd also like to
note that I hand package each one of these. So when you get the wrapping, which is in pristine this for fact, I'd like you to realize that this was my hard work, my love went into each package. And if you want to, when you subscribe, you can send me a little note via email and say, please send me a note, and I'll hand write something to you saying how amazing you are that I'm a human being. Or I'll draw something, and I'm not the best artist, but believe me, I will draw you a war scene of epic proportions. I do not care. I will do it for you. If you request it.
Yeah, that's how amazing The Means is.
Exactly.
Alright, so we'll see you guys next week. That's it for today.
Yep, talk to you guys later.
You have been listening to This Just In, recorded Sunday, November 13th, 2005, and released Monday, November 14th, 2005. For more information about this podcast, as well as other projects, please visit our website at www.the-means.com. We'll be right back.